will be spatial relativity. Could I just get, just to get a better idea, just with a show of hands up, hands of you who would say regularly or at least semi-regularly actually teach or expose your students to spatial relativity. Okay, so about two-thirds of the people. Great. So what this will be fairly sort of introductory. And what we'll focus on is space-time diagrams, which some people will be familiar with some people won't. And it'll be a very kind of gentle introduction to those. So, first of all, what I would like to begin with is, so one thing that special relativity does say, so Newtonian mechanics, Newton's laws of motion, they're a theory of motion that describe how, you know, typically they're very, very good for building bridges, describing how baseballs move, tennis balls, cars, and so forth. And so in some sense, special relativity is a theory of motion, and we think it applies at all velocities, but it just turns out that it really only comes into its own when things moving have very, very fast relative velocity. And what you mean by very, 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 very fast, that's when they get up kind of roughly in the same ballpark as the speed of light. So at the speed of light, or even sort of getting up the speed of light. So roughly round about, if you want sort of a cut, round about 25% speed of light and above in relativistic effects, where relativity starts to really diverge from Newtonian mechanics. Is true. And so just to give you, you know the speed of light, 300,000 kilometers per second, 3 by 10 to the 8 meters per second. And so if you were traveling at that speed, you could circle the entire globe at its weight around about 7 times every second. So it's light moves very fast. Okay. So just, and one thing that Einstein said, that when you actually get up to those speeds, you know, the same ballpark as the speed of light, then everything changes. And then what actually happens is in space and time actually start to mix up. You get time dilation, time stretches out in some sense, and also objects, in some sense, contract or shrink down like contraction. And so basically, if you were traveling close to the speed of light, then the world would seem very, 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 very strange. Things would look warped. Colors would change, you get relativistic Doppler effect, and it basically would look like you're in some kind of bizarre, surreal dream or a David Lynch movie. Okay. So what I will show you now is it's actually a simulation of what, this is a roller coaster ride, going, I'll just turn the lights down a bit, going at 99% speed of light. And so this basically, simulations some scientists have done using supercomputers took a lot of time, many, many hundreds of hours, but basically actually doing the relativistic optics, so basically figuring out what you would see at a roller coaster going at 99% speed of light. So what I will do is turn the sound okay, so turn this around. Yeah. And so there are actually a lot of effects happening. I will return to this, but I won't explain them right now. So we have a roller coaster at 99% speed of light. Thank you. Okay, that is special relative.
Do you have a website?
Einstein's website? If you Google search on through Einstein's eyes, it's the first thing that comes up.
I mean, could we watch that again? Would you be reading the writing underneath?
I'll just write. Actually, what I'd like to do is return to that a bit later on, if that's all right. So we will be going through, and it's probably about 10, 15 movies on there. Driving a car, watching a tram go past, almost at the speed of light. So yeah, we'll go through those and explain some of the facts. So there's actually a lot of things there. But I think it'll help if we do that, we'll reinforce some of the things we do. So, okay. So what I realize is a number of people are at various different levels, and so this will generally be a pretty introductory discussion. Actually, just a show of hands. Hands up who would say they feel familiar and comfortable with space-time diagrams. Okay, so about a third of the people. So great, thanks. Okay. Okay. So this will be probably fairly interactive for some people. But if you find yourself getting bored at any stage, I'll give you, some of you may know about the twin paradox. There's also another paradox called, there's a whole bunch of them. But there's one, it's a little bit more complicated, it's called skateboard and the manhole, or skateboard and the hole. So if this, at any point this is sort of true introduction for you, I'll just give you one paradox to think about. And it's just a street. The hole is 1 meter wide, so it could be a manhole cover or whatever there is there. Just some sort of hole in the street and skateboard that, when it rests, it's so you make that. Make that a bit more realistic, so a 50 centimeter hole measured at rest relative to the hole, and the rest frame the proper length, and 50 centimeter skateboard the proper length of that. And so if you put the hole or the skateboard just over the hole, then they just fit. But if you actually have, but according to special relativity, let's have the skateboard moving at a realistic speed of 99% speed of light. So if you have that basically shooting towards the hole here from this point of view, then what happens is that, I'll talk more about this in a minute, but the hole length contracts, and so that will appear shorter. So you'll have, from the point of view of the skateboard, we have very sort of narrow hole, long skateboard, so it doesn't fit. But if you reverse from the point of view of the hole, you then can have a very wide hole, or the stays the same width, and then a narrow skateboard because that length contracts. And so it can easily fit in from that perspective. But from the skateboard's perspective, it's actually not wide enough to fit in. So the paradox is, what happens to the skateboard? Does it actually fall in or not? So I'll talk about that probably Friday afternoon, but if you're familiar with space-time diagrams, you may wish to go over that now. So just maybe put that to one side. But okay, so we're going to start looking at two postulates of special relativity and two starting points. And we're going to be looking at basically plotting events in space and time, space-time diagrams, and the idea of kind of the sort of distance, if you like, in space and time. And then we're familiar with sort of switching between reference frames and perspectives. We'll look at that. And then look at time dilation, the fact that if you're looking at someone and they're moving at a very, very high constant speed relative to you, then you actually see them as if they're in a slow motion movie. Their time is sort of dilated or stretched out. Their time is slowed down. And then, for example, with the skateboard, if you're actually, again, if you're looking at, you know, a spaceship full of Klingons moving past at 99% the speed of light, you'll see that as actually shrunk or compressed kind of concertina depth. So that's an example we'll look at. And then the twin paradox. And the great thing about space-time diagrams is that, so it's a little bit of work to actually understand them and get them going, But essentially, I mean, what they are is this two-dimensional sort of x, y plot. Once we actually get to use them and understand them and get familiar with them, then basically all of these things fall out. And you can actually sort of derive or get length contraction and time dilation actually straight from the diagrams. Essentially, you can read them off from the diagrams without using formulas. And you can understand the twin products. You're basically in a graphical, pictorial way. And for a lot of people, especially visual learners, that's a very good thing. And it's just very, very transparent. You can kind of see them on the graphs. And that's there. And they're basically the results you get. They're sort of what you get for understanding space-time diagrams. So the next 2 days, that's actually where we'll be leading to. So some background. So Einstein, he said himself that he really first started thinking about relativity. The road to relativity started when he was 16 years of age. And often that's something I point out to students, because I guess some of your students were around about 16 years of age. And so what he was thinking about at that time, one of the thoughts, he had a daydream about riding alongside a beam of light that's shooting away, obviously, at the speed of light. And what he would actually see, what would the world be like if you were moving and zooming away at the speed of light? And it was only 10 years later, so that was 1895, it was 10 years later, 1905, when he finalized special relativity. But he said that was, you know, the thing that got me going. It's just this sort of seemingly innocent thought, this curiosity. As a child. So I find that kind of interesting. Special relativity was incredibly revolutionary. Before then, everyone pretty much believed and adhered to what Isaac Newton, the great giant British physicist, said about space and time. You know, space and time are absolute, eternal, sort of single time. And his ideas sort of were very prominent and held sway for over 200 years. And Einstein really overturned those, saying that in some sense space and time are relative, depending on your reference frame or your perspective. And so it was a very, very radical, very, very big impact. And it also actually sort of filtered into sort of the wider scene in terms of that had a cultural impact. I guess general relativity as well. But certainly general relativity, that was what made Einstein an international celebrity. People knew about it. Artists sort of tried to read about it and understand it. It sort of affected the way they did their art. So it was something that went sort of transcended science. And so again, it's a theory about space, time, and motion. And if you get what happens to these three things as relative velocities change. And one thing about it is it generally doesn't deal with acceleration. So we're just dealing with something moving at a constant speed in a single direction. So inertial preference frame, so acceleration is zero. So if you want to deal with accelerations, then you actually need to go to general relativity, which is, that would be a seven-week, seven-month Einstein class. So, okay. So one interesting thing about it is actually pretty much from just these two postulates, you can see, you can write down, but it don't involve any heavy mathematics. You can derive all of special relativity. You're just starting from these two postulates. So it's very, very, actually very, very compact. And it's kind of this elegance there. And that's one thing that why, in some sense, to physicists, it's a great theory. So physicists like elegance, we like simplicity and unification. But just from these two axioms, if you like, can kind of build up the rest of special relativity. And this sort of, in some ways, people talk about this as a template for a good theory. So string theory, a lot of scientists are working on string theory. We've got the Meet the Researchers lunch at 1 p.m. today. And at least one string theorist will be there. Hoping to get one more. But one thing about string theory that is appealing is that, so what string theory does is superstring theory. So it's a theory that instead of everything being made of atoms, roughly speaking, everything made up of tiny, tiny, much tinier strings. And you have a number of different types of atoms. There are, you know, 92 or however many elements there are in the periodic table that we know about. But in string theory, basically, it's just one type of string. That, you know, everything, all physical objects, all different types of atoms are just made up of different combinations of the one type of string. And it's one length, one tension, that's all it is. And so one reason why that's very appealing is just its compactness. It's just there's sort of one thing you start off with. And you've built up this great, great complex structure. And so in a sense, that kind of mirrors the template that Einstein had with special relativity. So this is all about physics, sort of distilling and simplifying the world as we know it. And so, and this was sort of part of Einstein's genius, just be able to get these two compact postulates. And so the first one, often called the relativity postulate, and that says the laws of physics, electromagnetism, motion, etc., all laws of physics are the same in all inertial reference frames. And all reference frames or perspectives that aren't speeding up or slowing down, that are not accelerating. And the second one is speed of light postulate. And that is all inertial observers, all observers that are not accelerating, speeding up or slowing down, measure light or see light traveling through empty space at the constant speed of c. So c, the symbol for the speed of light, and you know the speed 3 by 10 to 8 meters per second. And sometimes, you know, I draw a box around those, and I still find it kind of amazing that just from those two things alone, you can build the whole scaffolding, pretty much, of special relativity. So these are two postulates. So what actually is an inertial reference frame? So as I said, it's just something. So in relativity, acceleration is an absolute thing. And so essentially, it's just, so an example of an inertial reference frame is the reference frame that coincides with a car traveling on a road at 60 kilometers per hour. It's a straight freeway, a highway, straight line at 100 kilometers per hour, for example. It's an example of an inertial reference frame. And also about inertial reference frames, the thing is Newton's first law holds that an isolated body moving at a constant velocity or at rest actually continues to move at that constant velocity or at rest unless acted on by some external force. So if that, you can use that kind of a test for an inertial frame, some sort of practical test, if you like, or semi-practical test, that actually in accelerating frames, you actually kind of, from their perspective, you spontaneously get objects just seeming to accelerate without any cause because of those perspectives that reference frame you're in. So one thing just about the relativity postulate, so it comes from a kind of democratic sort of perspective, or the idea that physics should be universal, that it shouldn't be just sort of this reference frame or that reference frame. There shouldn't be any privileged reference frame. That where the laws of physics apply, and you have to be in that reference frame. It shouldn't matter, you know, all reference frames, you know, whether they're at rest with respect to Earth or not, as long as they're not accelerating, the laws of physics should hold. Because after all, there's nothing fundamentally, if we think of it from an astronomical point of view, special about Earth, because that's, you know, traveling around the sun, and the sun is part of the solar system, and that's, you know, part of some a spiral arm of the Milky Way galaxy, and that's moving, and that galaxy is moving relative to other galaxies and anything, so there shouldn't, it would be very strange if in the entire universe, you know, you had to be in the on rest with respect to the surface of the Earth to get your physics to work. And so in 1905, in some ways, it was both a very, very revolutionary idea, but also there were some precursors to it. So Galileo, in the 17th century, he said that the laws of mechanics, so the laws of motion and so forth, were the same in all reference frame. And so that was, in a sense, people talk about that as Galilean relativity. So this wasn't as if the idea was never out there, but what Einstein did, so you notice the difference, instead of the laws of physics, we have the laws of mechanics. And so what Einstein did, the revolutionary aspect, was to really expand or enhance Galileo's relativity postulate, and to broaden it to include all physics. So, for example, what was known about the time about electromagnetism, Maxwell's equations. And so part of his genius was really just to boldly believe within that and to go for it. And even though he actually knew that that had actually very, very radical implications. So he knew that if you believe that, you had to commit to believing that speed of light was independent of your relative to velocity to the source of the light. Something weird had to change with just the velocity addition laws with light. And in some sense, so Maxwell's equations, they were sort of probably near the end of the 19th century. And so he knew that they were incompatible with Newton's equations. So in some sense, you have Newton's laws of motion on the one hand, which had been around for about 300 years, and Maxwell's equations, which would be around for, say, about 25 years. And he knew that there was some incompatibility in terms of how they transformed, and he had to sort of go with one of them. And he had, I guess, the courage to go with the younger theory, the theory, and just follow the consequences on from that. And it turned out that was the right thing to do, which is not at all obvious. And so one view of the relativity postulate, so to get an idea of it. So imagine you wake up one morning and you find yourself in an unfamiliar room. And you don't know how you got there, you just woke up. And a strange man and a woman walk up to you and say that you've been kidnapped. But they'll let you go if they, you can tell. So it's a room, it's sort of black, there are no windows, you can't see outside, you can't feel any noticeable motion. So it's just this bare room. And they say they'll let you go if you can tell if the room is A, fixed to the ground and stationary with respect to it on here on Earth, or it's moving inside a plane flying at a very, very low altitude at a constant velocity with respect to the surface of the Earth. So if you can distinguish between those two possibilities. And so what the relativity postulate, so you know, but they say, look, you know, we know that you're a physics teacher, so what we'll do is we'll allow you to do any kind of experiment they want. So they actually bring out kinds of ammeters and voltmeters and resistors and whatever, linear air track machine. And so they say you can do any kind of physics experiment you like. The only caveat is you have to actually use stuff that's in the room. You can't call a friend outside or anything like that. You can only use information in the room. So what the relativity postulate says is there's no reliable way to distinguish between those two possibilities, no matter what equipment you have. Because if the laws of the physics are the same, no matter whether you're just still moving at a constant velocity, then any physics experiment you do will be the same. So if you did all the labs you do with your students, if you chartered a plane and flew that at a low altitude, at a very low altitude at a constant velocity, then all the experiments would actually turn out to be the same. So the two situations are indistinguishable. So that's one way of looking at the relativity postulate. There's nothing special about the frame that this frame we're in now being So moving on to the next postulate, the speed of light postulate. So crudely speaking, that says that everyone measures light travel at sea, the same speed, the same velocity. And that's kind of counterintuitive. And so hopefully this is sort of a very gentle exercise. Hopefully it's we'll see how this goes, but it's not meant to be. So in particular, this question is not meant to be a trick question at all. So the answer is very, very simple, I assure you. And so let's just sort of ease into that. Let's think about one day. So this was for Canadian schools. So I tried to think of something with snow that kind of understand. I had beaches and palm trees and surfboards, but people weren't getting it. So, so we have a hill here. It's very winter's day. You actually start basically tobogganing down the hill and you get to the bottom, down this horizontal area. Well, actually, you have three friends that do that. And they get going pretty fast, around about 30 kilometers per hour. And then while they're going up 30 kilometers per hour, they say, okay, let's have some fun. They pick up some snow and make a snowball and actually throw that at you. So that's the kind of you there, standing there looking at your friends. And they throw the snowball so that relative to them, from their perspective in the toboggan, it moves at 15 kilometers per hour away from them. And the question is, what speed will you see the snowball moving towards you at? So the toboggan has 30 kilometers per hour speed, and then the snowball moves away from the toboggan at 15 kilometers per hour, just so that we can, hope this is not insulting your intelligence, just if we can sort of wake up, maybe you discuss those with the people around you, what speed you see the snowball moving towards you at, whether it's A, B, C, or D. So again, it's not meant to be a trick question, so I'll give you about maybe 20 seconds to consult people around you. And also, what misconceptions might lead students to come up with the other answers? So I'll give you maybe 1.5 minutes. I'm going to go to the next slide. Oh, it's very, very much fun. What's your name? That's true. So nursery funds generally, they're only, but if the time period is short enough, so nursery funds in fact, in reality, they're always for a specified, only for a specified area. So I mean, and basically every example like that, eventually you can never get. Okay, that's enough time. Okay, everyone put their answers up. Okay. There's some very high-tech whiteboards here. Okay. A, fantastic, great. Correct answer. Okay, let's change it slightly. So let's replace a snowball. Let's replace a snowball by a photon. So just a single photon. So somehow you have a single photon laser, or you just happen to have one, or your friends do there, and they have a photon, and obviously the photon moves away from them, not at 15 kilometers per hour, but at the speed c, speed of light, 3 by 10 to the 8 meters per second. So what speed will you see the photon moving towards you at? These are the four options. Again, consult with people around you to find the right answer, and also what misconceptions would lead students to come up and believe in the three answers that you don't think are correct. So it's the same thing, just replacing the snowball with the photon.
Thank you.
Okay, we might come back now. Okay, so hands up who thinks the correct answer, or should maybe if everyone can put up their answers. Great. Okay, everyone's awake this morning. Fantastic. And what is that? Swimming a vacuum. Okay. Okay, there's always a few ones. Okay, great, that's the correct answer. So what we'll do, so I think we'll skip this one, but the next one, so often when I do this with students, they say, okay, let's ramp up the speed to a very realistic 100,000 kilometers per second. So that's actually a third of the speed of light. And what actually happens? And then I say that surely, you know, that has to make a difference. The speed at which you see the photon moving towards you, kind of giving it 100,000 kilometers per second extra boost when it goes up. And so of course, maybe we'll do that one again. So I'll give you 5 seconds to write that correct answer. Okay, great. Okay, so I think, okay, everyone. And so the interesting thing is you can do the same question again, but you can say, okay, let's make changes slightly, let's get rid of the toboggan, and let's replace it by a subatomic particle, moving at 99.9% speed of light. And then you can say, well, you know, let's make a particular subatomic particle, you know, about electrons, and it turns out there are another type of subatomic particle, it's called a pion. So it's, you know, kind of like an electron, but it's a little bit different. And then if you have that, so that emits a photon. And then if you had that, basically you have pretty much exactly the same setup they had in an experiment they did at CERN, the big particle accelerator right next to Geneva in 1964. And so they can get these pions, these subatomic particles, they can just speed them up using massive magnets, really, really huge magnetic fields. And they can get them going to 99% the speed of light. And then in the experiment they did, we didn't throw out a photon, but they emitted light, or at least light in the form of gamma rays, so high-frequency radiation. And when they did that, what they actually found, basically they had some sort of arrangement of detectors to measure the speed of light. So they take the place of you just to see how quickly the speed of light is moving towards you. And so, in a sense, what you're doing is giving light basically a 99.9% speed of light boost. So basically the source is moving relative to you at that speed. And so I think common sense is sort of screaming out, surely that must make the light move towards you faster. It might give the light some kind of an extra speed up. But as you know, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. And you could change it, you could have the pion moving away from you at 99% speed of light. And I mean, this common sense is you could add the two velocities together, and that's exactly what you do. Normally, but you don't. So you know that it just moves at c, the speed of light. Yes.
I think from the instructional point of view, this is a beautiful exercise. If in the very first one, where the toboggan is going, you would ask the students also what speed do the students, the kids in the toboggan see?
Oh, okay, right, yeah.
What speed would be on the snowball
right.
measure?
Yeah.
And here, because then I think the fact that from all systems, the speed of light is the same, is much stronger.
Okay, yeah, that's true.
It would be beautiful to do it from all.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good idea because some students might think, oh, well, just to be really clear,
that it's from all records, because in the first case, they're all different, and the other is not the same.
Good point. Okay, great, agree with that. And so really what we're seeing is, special relativity. What we're really seeing is special relativity kick in. And that the standard law of additional velocities does not hold. And so we're actually seeing something very, very strange happening with the speed of light, something very unusual. And if you look at speed is measured in units of a distance divided by time, meters per second, for example. And so if something very, very strange is happening with the speed of light, then that suggests something strange is happening with space, distance, and with time, duration. And that's what happens pretty much from this postulate, plus the relativity postulate, You can actually, this is why fairly simple arguments, they just demand that you radically, if you believe in both of those, then you can follow logical arguments, they just demand that you have to radically overhaul your ideas about space and time, and they lead you to time dilation. Again, if you're watching a spaceship full of Klingons moving past at half the speed of light or 75% speed of light, then you actually see their time as slowed down. Basically, that's time dilation stretched out and length contraction as well. So space-time diagrams. So let's consider three kind of happenings or events. And one is an apple falling from a tree, and the tree is just some location in a park, field, or something like that. A bird taking flight from a tree. And a car comes to a stop at a set of traffic lights, C. So they're three different events. And so they're going to occur somewhere at some particular location, and they will occur at some time. And so what it's natural to do is to plot them or represent them just on a graph with time and space in it. And so imagine what we need to do is imagine. So it's kind of hard. So really we have three dimensions of space and one of time, but I'm very bad at drawing four-dimensional diagrams. So if that's all right with you, then we'll just have one dimension of space just to keep the diagram two-dimensional. So what that means, I need to actually assume, is that the events all happen aligned. So maybe we just have the ground here. So we've got the ground, and they all sort of happen along this line here at various times. So, actually, I'll keep it consistent with the diagram. So A might happen there. That's the apple and the tree. And then I guess along a bit further, we've got it's a bird. And then the car. Actually, yeah, that works out. The car seat. So they all happen in a line. We could call this the x-axis or the space axis. We don't have time in there. They're just where they happen. This doesn't specify when they happen. But what we could do is we could... So imagine that they... Well, what happens is that event A happens. So they're those happenings. We'll call them events. And then C happens. A little bit later, B happens. So the apple falls, the car stops, then the bird takes flight. And so basically, we're going to kind of mark them out where they occur. Well, we know where they occur in space. It's kind of in this order here. So we just sort of get the x, or if you like, the space coordinate. And we know that this one happens first, the apple. Oh, actually, probably about the same time. Okay, the same time. And then the bird, and then at the same time, the car comes to a stop. So what we do is we plot those on this sort of diagram in space and time. That's what we get. And we can sort of give it to a lot of useful information about it. And so, by convention, we could have had, why do we have time in the vertical axis in space? So we could have swapped the axes around. But let's just choose one way of doing it and stick to one. And just the convention is to put time on the vertical axis. And I kind of, it seems natural to me now, I just think of time as kind of flowing onwards as we go up. And so that's, again, normal diagram. That's... And so that actually is a space-time diagram. So this is what we're going to be looking at. It's just a way, a graphical way of just getting a handle on things that happen and events and happenings. And so this is one example. And so why do we call it a space-time diagram? Why do we actually have this sort of new word where we sort of merge space and time into one? What we do, basically, because in some sense, when you get traveling very, very fast, actually, time and space actually get mixed up and actually lose their independent identity. And we'll see examples of that. And that's what you get with time dilation. And so one way of thinking about time dilation and the length contraction is that space and time are actually being mixed up in different reference frames when you're actually moving very, very fast relative to some other object. That's the cause of it. And so basically, these two things kind of get blended or mixed in together, or like two ingredients in a recipe. And so what we have is a quote here by Herman Minkowski, who actually kind of came up with the idea of space-time diagrams. And that is, he said about special relativity, henceforth space by itself and time by itself are doomed to fade away into mere shadows, and only a kind of union of the two will preserve an independent reality. And so in special relativity, there's no fundamental distinction between space and time. There's just this one kind of blob of stuff, and that's space-time. And so that's why, essentially, we have this new term, space-time diagram. So we'll see some examples of that. Because what it turns out is what we see as time and we see as space. If we talk to the aliens on the Klingon ship moving past us at 50% the speed of light, they will actually see different things as space and time. What they will see as space and what they will see as time will actually be a mixture of both of the things that we call space and time. And so kind of our space and our time get mixed up and called their time and their space. And so this is, we have this kind of blending effect of space and time. This is why we have this new word. And so that is what individual happenings, or let's call them events, or look like on a space-time diagram. What do a whole series of events? Imagine we have this whole sequence of events. So we have a car driving along at 60 kilometers per hour in one direction on a highway. What will that look like on a space-time diagram? So basically, we just take all the individual points and we sort of plot them one by another. We actually build up a line. So let's say the car starts at time zero at the origin, and then it's moving towards the right in the positive x direction. So it's moving along a line. So it's obviously going to move towards the right here. And just as we go further in time, as we go higher up, it'll get further and further along, further away from the origin. So we get points here, here, and here. And it's moving at constant velocity, so the slope of the graph will be constant. And so that kind of plots out on a space-time diagram as a way of representing how the car moves. And so we can, technically, there's a technical term for that. That describes all the motion or what the car is doing in the world, in the universe, if you like. And it's a line, so we call it a world line. So that's one example of plotting what happens in a space-time diagram. And you can see already, it's sort of a nice way to get a handle of what the car is doing. You get this nice pictorial representation. You can see just a line on a graph how the car is moving. And this is one advantage of space-time diagrams. And so what we'll do now is I'll get you to basically plot some space-time diagrams. So this one's very similar to the last one, except the only thing is that the car changes direction. So going towards the right, they're actually going to reverse back and go towards the left. So what you can do is you can actually basically build all these up by just thinking about all the different sequence events, one event, two event, three event, you get all these dots, and then sort of join those up to find out what the car's having. So what we'll do is we can talk to people around you, and then maybe divide your boards up into quarters, and then in each quarter, you could put the answer to 1, 2, 3, and 4 there. So I just want you to draw.
It's just like your legs. You know, your legs are
Okay, how are you going for it? So essentially that is right. So this is the example of Yeah. Yeah, so that's actually, that will, that will be the biggest part of this. So it's hard to do what I'm
doing.
You kind of represent it, you do a representation. Okay, great. Okay, so we'll, so for everyone, we, hopefully everyone's got them now. So something actually, one point someone mentioned was, actually, it was a good point that I said that the convention is to put time on the vertical axis and space on the horizontal axis. I didn't realize that that's pretty much the opposite of what you do in Newtonian mechanics. You do position versus time graphs. And I thought about it, so it's pretty stupid, but somewhere along the line, some physicists decided that in relativity we should put space on the time on the vertical axis. I don't know if it was Feynman or probably Minkowski. And so it's just inconsistent. So it's just that was what someone decided. So there's absolutely no reason why you couldn't swap them around as they are normally, but it's just... Yeah.
I don't think it's stupid, actually. It helps distinguish this thing as your DT graph.
Okay,
This is a different thing.
Okay.
It's a convention, but I think it helps with the two tools.
Yeah, okay.
But this
good
is
point.
A convention throughout, like, any...
Yep, go to any physics library in the world, look at any textbook on special relativity, then you build this. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so what we'll do is,
there's a resource I'll mention later from the Mechanical Universe series on special relativity, and they do an incredible job with space-time diagrams.
Okay,
and
great.
And it fits, correlates exactly.
Okay. So if everyone could hold up their answers, and I'll read every single one of them, and I'll see if they're right. Yeah. Okay, maybe the facilitator look around.
Well, I see that there are a couple of different answers for the second one, that some people are saying that it's just a dot, some people are saying that it's a vertical line, so maybe you could just say to your partner why
it's not a line or why it's not a dot.
Okay, great. So I think, yes?
In relativity, we were talking about quantum mechanics, especially all this. Do we ever have negative time? Not the change in time is negative, but actually negative time?
So in some sense, so you can. I mean, where you define time zero is arbitrary. So you might say, well, we should define it, the Big Bang was time zero. But just as if you have an x-axis space, where you define space zero is, and where you find the origin is arbitrary. You choose that. So I mean, if I define time zero to be tomorrow at 12 noon, then we're actually in negative time now. So normally you don't, because it just makes sense to define the first time as time zero and go beyond that. But you can. It just means time before, and you can have negative time. Even if we define time zero to be now, so we could just talk about, we could do a space-time diagram for you, all of your movements yesterday, and that would have negative time. So, but what's weird, you never really have happen is things going backwards in time. So things always go up in time.
So really, we don't have a forward direction of time.
Yeah. Unless you get into very crazy stuff. So, a tachyon, for example. But, okay. So, looked like most of the people did have the right one for the first one. But if it was 50-50, then again, that's just a fantastic way that I know, okay, I need to explain that. that point a lot more. The fourth one, what I did notice, what this technique was really good for me, you know, some people, a lot of people that had different representations. And so that was actually a very challenging question because it's, I mean, it's just, you probably know what the answer is, but it's just hard to represent three-dimensional sort of motion on basically a two-dimensional surface. And so there are probably different ways you can represent that. I think people brought that out. I know someone I was talking to about. But the one way is, I think people had, you can kind of try and represent. So what we'll do, essentially, if you plot, if you just look at the space and forget about the time, it's going around a circle. So it will do this. But what's happening is going forwards in time. And so if you have that as being x and y dimensions, and you have this going around in a circle, but it's just that at each point in the circle, you're as if you're raising or going up at a constant rate. And so you actually get some sort of a spiral. In that case, would be spiraling upwards. So it's like a corkscrew. So if you kind of want to represent that in a perspective, you have what a lot of people have. Okay. So it's funny to see the, I've actually been to some lectures and the physicists have put up every single blackboard with equations and so forth, and then you see them searching around. But it's fair backwards. I find it. Yes.
But you're changing direction all the time, so it's under constant acceleration. So is that still work?
Oh, right. So that still works. So you can say independent of special relativity, where we're dealing with special relativity, you can still have space-time dynamics outside of special relativity, and you can still plot them. So there are different opinions on that, but strictly speaking, just to know exactly all the details of the physics, what happens in that case, you would have to go outside of special relativity because it doesn't deal with acceleration, but you can still, in that case, still get a space-time diagram. Yep. So what I saw most people had was kind of like a corkscrew. So that's x, y, and time. And I think I saw some other people, a few other people had, was it something like, did anyone have something like that? Could someone like explain their thinking behind that?
It's a projection.
Projection, okay.
Yeah,
so
because when you try to draw the spiral, it would look like you went back on time. So in order to avoid that, we have to project it.
No, okay, so you're looking at projection, say, on the x-axis, for example. Yep, okay, so good, yep. So that works, the different representation. So
would that be more like an oscillating spring, though?
But if you've got something uniform circular motion, you look at the x component or the y component, then it's executing simple harmonic motion. So, So that's a pretty tough one, but I figure you can handle it. Okay, so space-time diagrams. Hopefully, it's starting to kind of make sense. So. We might do just for it. So let's look at the idea of sort of metric or distance in space and time. So what we can do is, so very familiar with the idea of, imagine we want to calculate the distance between two points, between points A and B on a map, and could pick a random country. I didn't even notice. a random country and two points, say Brisbane and Sydney, and then neglecting the curvature of the surface of the Earth in this case, just use the Pythagoras' theorem to calculate the distance between. So the distance between A and B, or the square of it, which we'll call D, is just the square of the x distance plus the square of the y distance. So just the Pythagoras formula. And if you want to be really fancy, this gives us a measure of the distance between those two points, between A and B. And sort of mathematically, scientists or mathematicians talk about it as a metric equation. So metric is just a fancy way to express people if you're talking about distance, roughly speaking. And so that's, in a sense, like a distance equation. It gives you a measure of you have two points, what's the distance between A and B, if you like, the metric. So this is the standard thing. And so we've got this space-time diagram. So it's natural to get an idea of distance in special relativity. What kind of, if we have 2 points, A and B, what's the distance between them? And so, what you might think, well, the most natural thing to think, well, it's exactly like the Pythagorean theorem. So what it is, it's just the distance between them is delta x squared, and then maybe something like delta t squared. But if it was delta x squared plus delta t squared, then, well, that wouldn't make sense, because, you know, they're adding one thing to another. You've got to make sure that the units are right, the dimensions are right. And for x squared is dimensions of length squared, and time squared is dimensions of dimensions of time squared, obviously. So if we, you know, the units don't actually, or the dimensions don't actually mesh, so if we actually multiply the time by some sort of a speed, and let's choose the speed of light, then they actually have the same dimensions. You do a dimensional analysis, they basically have, you know, meter squared, meter squared. And you're adding together, that's fine. So that would be a very natural choice for actually kind of the metric or the sort of the distance between 2 points. And so is that actually correct? Or maybe there's something kind of strange in special relativity about space and time. So let's actually see whether it's that or whether it's something else. So this is not a strict derivation of what the metric equation is, the analogous thing for Pythagoras' theorem, but it's kind of a plausibility argument, and you can make it rigorous. So to help decide, let's look at something called a light clock. And this would be something that's very familiar to a lot of people. It's in a lot of textbooks. And it's really a clock that, you know, we have these clocks, digital clocks, analog clocks. So what they do is they measure time by some sort of second hand ticking away or some sort of crystal here at a certain frequency. But you can measure time by any regular process, really. And particularly, you could have two mirrors and just have photon or any, doesn't have to be single photon, or just some light that actually somehow use that sort of bouncing back and forwards between these two mirrors that are a constant distance apart, and light, given what it will do is it will travel at constant speed up and down, back and forth. So so we could imagine we could call a tick of one tick of the clock the time it takes for the light to go up there and then back, and repeat two ticks up and back, three ticks, and so forth. So that's a regular process. That's a way we could actually choose to measure time. And we call that a light clock. And again, that will be familiar to a number of you when you're... and so we have is L, is just the vertical distance between the mirrors. And let's look at it from the perspective of, first of all, someone at rest with respect to the light clock, just at rest with respect to the mirrors. And we'll call that person sort of S. And so they're just standing there, you've just got two mirrors there. The two mirrors, you stack one above the other. And you could maybe, you have a little hole just in there, and you shine a laser beam up. And you look at the time for the start and the pulse of the laser beam just to go up and back down and goes up. And just keeps on repeating, keeps on just going back and forth, back and forth. And every time it comes back down to the bottom, that's kind of one tick of your clock. And fundamentally, that's just as good a clock in principle as a digital watch or a grandfather clock. So that's a light clock, but also we can look at things from a different perspective, from a different reference frame. And so we can actually look at, imagine we have someone else, so we'll call them S dash, so you have a friend, and they're moving at some velocity relative to the light clock. So they're moving to the left relative to the light clock. And say, let's make it a very, very high, this velocity doesn't matter, but generally, for this to be significant, they need to be moving at a fair fraction of the speed of light. But they're just moving to the left. And so from their reference frame, so I should say it's very important at a constant velocity. So same direction, not speeding up or slowing down. And so from their point of view, their perspective, they're still in their reference frame. So what's the mirror doing? If they're moving to the left, from their point of view, I'm not moving, I'm in my reference frame. And so the clock, the mirrors are actually moving towards the right. And so what they'll see the tick of the clock being is not the light and the photon going up and down, but they'll actually see it as sort of going in a diagonal path up and right, and then diagonal path down and to the left. So they actually see basically the photon go up like that and down like that. And depending on what velocity they they're traveling at, that will mean there'll be some horizontal distance here, d, in between the two successive ticks of the clock, between the photon going up and coming back down. And what we're going to do is, so again, we looked at this idea of events or happenings. An event is just anything that happens at a particular place at a particular time in special relativity. There was the bird, the tree, and the car. And so two more events are the light leaving here and then returning there. We'll call them A and B. And what we want to do is have a look just at the time and the interval and the distance, if you like, in space and time, or the interval between these two events on our space-time diagram. So
A and B aren't a different clock, they're the same clock from a different perspective?
They're just different events. They're the photon for the first time leaving this wall here. So what you could have is you could have a little small hole there and a laser beam, and you could press a button, turn it on, and so when you turn it on, the photon starts moving up this way, or up here from this perspective, and so the event of the photon just leaving and going up after you've turned the laser beam on, that you could call that, okay, let's call that event A, and so it climbs up towards the top mirror, hits there, bounces back, comes down after a certain amount of time, and you could say just when it hits the bottom mirror again, call that event B. So, okay, that's B. So that's what I mean. And what we can do is, we need a symbol for the space-time distance, or, I mean, distance is just some sort of interval. It's an interval between one thing or another. So we'll just use to distinguish between the distance that we have in space, normally D. For example, in the last case, we're talking about a distance or in space and time. So what we'll actually use is we'll just use a different symbol because it might turn out to be something different. And so we use S, so a lowercase s here for the interval or the distance in space and time that we're actually trying to measure, trying to get a handle of. So in frame S, from the point of view of the person just at rest with respect to the mirror, what we have is this interval or this distance is just made up of time. So these events, so if we plot them, is there an array? Is there an array anywhere? No, that's fine.
As long as it's on the screen.
Oh, on the shelf.
Oh, okay.
So, not very good.
So, from the point of view of S, the distance or the interval between A and B is just made up of time. They occur at the same place, so there's no difference in distance here, so it's just time. So time is really only going to be making up the interval. So what we can tell, again, this is not a proof, but a plausibility argument, you can actually make it rigorous. But seeing the interval is just made up of time, then let's just make the interval between them just the time difference between these two points. So it leaves the first mirror, actually starts when we turn the button on the laser beam, and goes up, and after, I don't know, 10 seconds, 5 seconds, 14 seconds, or actually probably it would be a couple of nanoseconds for any kind of realistic clock, what you would have is gets to the middle, so I guess the point would be there halfway when it gets to the top and then comes back down again, probably a couple of nanoseconds, and then we just measure the interval, the distance is just the time between the two, so T2 minus T1. But what we'll actually do is, is just measure that time, but we'll measure it using different units. So we'll see. And what a very, so in a sense, so what you might say is that time is 10. So time is given by distance divided by speed. So the natural thing to do would be to just take the distance, which is L going up, L going back. So we get 2L divided by the speed, which gives us C. So that would be the natural thing for the time. But let's just change units of the time a bit. And so instead of representing them, so that might be seconds there, but okay, so instead of representing time in units of seconds, let's represent time in terms of distance. So it's a little bit strange, and in a sense, you might call it light time. But let's represent the time interval between two events or any two things happening. Not as you know, the time in seconds, but just the time, but in distance by measuring it by the distance that light travels in that time under consideration. So if you want to represent in light time, if you like, 1 second, then how far does something actually, how far does light travel in 1 second? So that might be, so let's say SI units, 1 second, how far does light travel? It's three by 10 to the 8 meters. So we can actually represent 1 second by 3 by 10 to the 8 meters. And you can have any multiples of a second. So what we have is if we have any multiples of that, so then time sort of, X seconds is then represented by 3 by 10 to the eighth multiplied by X meters. So it's a very, very strange way of representing time. But it works. So if you know what the convention is, it's just a different set of units. So if you give someone any value for meters, then you just divide that by the speed of light, and you can get a time. So it's kind of a strange thing to do, but in some sense, it's not so strange. So we do mix up space and time, or distance and time, sometimes. If we ask, at least measuring the other way around, measuring distance in terms of time. So sometimes you say, oh, how far away is Toronto from here? Some people might say, oh, it's about 2 hours drive away. And so Toronto, the distance, you're asking for a distance. It's about 100 kilometers from here to Toronto. But people might say, oh, it's about 2 hours drive away or an hour and a half drive or something like that. And you understand what that means, even though the answer, if you look at it strictly speaking, it's time. So it doesn't make sense, but just sort of translating from distance to time is something that we do in common everyday speech. And so here we're just doing the opposite, translating from time into distance. So, and also if we're looking for, it's something the units work out, so we're looking for some kind of a distance. Distance is sort of in meters. So what we actually want to do is, if we want something that has units of meters, and it turns out that in this case, what we're doing is does. We've got units of meters there. And so this is the time. We actually want to measure this time interval by the distance that light travels in that time interval. And so the distance that light travels in the time interval of going up here, back down to there, in this reference frame, rest to it, well, it travels a distance L going up to there, and then a distance L going back. And so that's 2L. And then so the space-time interval in this frame between the two events A and B that we're trying to find, this kind of distance or interval here, is we'll measure that, denote that by 2L. So just using kind of light time, we have the distance, the space-time interval S of 2L, or the distance between those. So that's what that is. And now, let's look at the distance in from the perspective of someone moving to the left, the person at this very, very high speed moving to the left, away from here. And so what we want is obviously the distance between any two things in space doesn't depend on, in everyday experience, on your relative velocity. You know, anyone measure the distance between Brisbane and Sydney or Waterloo and Toronto, doesn't matter whether you're measuring that basically in a car moving at 60 kilometers per hour and a plane overhead, it's long, or in a spaceship, in a satellite or whatever, speeding past at a very, very high speed. It's just as long as you have accurate measuring devices, you can be any frame of reference or any relative velocity with respect to the distance you're trying to measure, and you'll get the same right answer. So we want that kind of universality for the metric, or for, sorry, the distance between these events in space and time. So we're looking for something that all observers, no matter what their reference frame is, what their perspective is, they give the same answer, S. So this is what we're looking for here. So from the point of view of S dash, what's the time between A and B? So the time between this event happening and that event happening. And so time, we know time is given by distance divided by speed. And so we know for this, so we know what does this person measure the speed of the light to travel at? Well, everyone measures the speed of light to be c. And so this is c, the speed of light, and what's the distance? Well, the distance is this diagonal path here plus that diagonal path there. They're the same. And so what we need to do is just figure out this diagonal length from Pythagoras. And we've got this length here, which is L. This is distance D. So half here is D divided by 2. So this distance here of the diagonal line is L squared plus D divided by 2 squared. And then take the square root of all of that, which is what we get here. And we've got two of those, 1, 2. So we need to get double that distance to find out the total distance of light travel. What's its speed? C. And so what we do is we divide those one by the other. We get the time elapsed from the point of view of the person moving to the left. So what we do is we have this equation here. We have that equation. What we'll do is notice there's L appears in both equations. And so let's just make L the subject here, divide both sides by 2. We get L equals S divided by 2 here. And then just plug this into this equation here. And then so we get, what we do is we get S squared divided by 2 squared, which is 4. And so we actually notice that we get, so if you notice you get 2 there divided by S squared divided by 4, and there's D squared divided by 4. And if we actually bring the 2 inside under the square root, we have to square that, so that becomes a 4. So we get S squared multiplied by 4 divided by 4, so the 4s cancel out. And we get d squared multiplied by 4 divided by 4, so the 2's cancel out, and again we get d squared. So we just get l squared plus d squared divided by c equals t there. And if we square both sides just to get rid of the square root, what we have is t squared, or t dash squared equals s squared plus d squared divided by c squared there. And then take the c squared multiplied both sides by c squared, then you actually end up with this here, which is S squared equals L. We can see what the formula is there. And that, it turns out, is the metric equation for special relativity. And so the important thing is, the strange thing is, the weird thing is, that you actually have this minus sign here. So if we go back to what we had for Pythagoras or Euclidean or normal space, is it's something plus something else, or something squared plus something else squared, but here we have this minus sign. And so this is where a lot of the weirdness comes in special relativity. Talk more about this later. But what this is actually saying is that actually space and time and the way they're interrelated to each other, the way they're connected, is not something that, it's something that's unexpected and something that's interesting. And there's a lot of the consequences like time dilation and special relativity are really related to that. But mathematically, it's kind of an abstract thing, but a lot of the weirdness or the counterintuitive effects are actually tied up with this negative sign. So, just finally, so you might say, well, why can't you just make that a plus sign, and why can't you just say something like, you might think that the most obvious thing to try is that if you want to measure some kind of distance, or if you like, or interval between two things in the space of time, the most natural thing to try is that, but it turns out if you look at that in special relativity, special relativity gives you formulas for telling how that, what that amount is from different perspectives or different reference frames, and it turns out that that quantity, if you look at it in different reference frames or different perspectives, different observers will get radically different values for that. And so what that will mean is, I could be here stationary, measure the space-time interval, the distance between two events in space and time, say A and B from my reference frame, and I could get one value for this quantity, and someone else moving again, a Klingon moving in a spaceship at 50% the speed of light, or someone moving in another galaxy moving at 90% the speed of light with respect to Earth, will actually measure or get different values for those. And so we'll actually get three different values of those three different reference frames for what the space-time interval, or if you like, the distance in space and time is between these two events. And that's in a sense, that's silly. It doesn't make sense, because the distance, for it to be a kind of a useful quantity in science, for it to be of any use or universality or something we really want to actually make the part of our core of our theory, it should be something that's independent of observers, so we should all measure the same value, so we can all talk to each other. But this quantity here is just, it's variable. It really depends on your individual perspective, and so it really kind of doesn't have much of a use at all as kind of a distance measure. It doesn't satisfy this universality property that we really want for a distance or a metric measure. So that's why that doesn't work out. And this actually does. All perspectives, all observers, no matter what their reference frame, measure the same value for S squared, this value. So what we'll do now is, it's coffee break time. So we'll have coffee break for 15 minutes, and then more space time going.